Welcome to Our Wellspring. In today's episode, we speak with Jessica and Joanna Berwin, directors of Springpoint Partners. Jessica and Joanna tell us about their family life and upbringing as sisters and partners, and their journey as they imagined, grappled, reimagined, and then seeded Springpoint Partners with their siblings. Jessica and Joanna tap into the importance of mistake-making, learning, and unleashing creativity. They also reflect on legacy building, on honoring time-tested traditions while also stretching into their own leadership posture and centering their passions. Hear them talk about learnings gleaned from their dad, who both challenged and inspired them to work through paradoxes and to grow and lead their way. This is Our Wellspring. Bienvenidos.
I'll just ask to begin, how are you? How are you today? How are you feeling? How are you coming into our time together?
Feeling a little anxious and a little bit tired. That's mostly how I'm feeling today.
I would ditto that. A little anxious, a little tired, but also excited just to see where the conversation goes. I think it's just an opportunity to reflect on what we've built, and that is, it's always a good thing to do because we surprise ourselves sometimes, I think.
I hope we will.
Well, my goal then will be to make sure that by the end of this conversation, we can maybe turn down the knob on the anxiety just a little bit, and hopefully we land in an even better place. But I get the anxiety. I have a little bit of jitters as well. I think a good place to start would be to just hear a little bit about who you are. Tell us, for those who don't know you, Jessica and Joanna, tell us a little bit about who you are.
Well, I'm Joanna Berwin, youngest member of four siblings, the fifth generation in a family business that was started in the late 1800s. Co-founder of Springpoint Partners with my siblings and founder of The Hive, whose mission is to amplify voice, choice, and opportunity for all young people. And mother of three.
Mm-hmm. I love that you smiled even more at that last part. Thank you for that. And Jessica.
And I am Jessica Berwin, second of four in my family, mother of one. I'm going to start there. Mother of one and stepmother of others. And co-founder of Springpoint Partners, which I cannot believe is, you know, has had quite the runway that it's had already. Not the runway, though. Can't believe it's been around for as long as it has now. I'm an artist. I'm a metalsmith, also a painter occasionally, and I live in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
That Philadelphia. Yeah. You both touched on, I think, one of the main reasons we're here, which is to talk about Springpoint Partners. I think there's this formal language we all use when we talk about Springpoint, right? How we work with those individuals, networks, solutions, leaders who are really powering change, change we care deeply about. But I would ask, if you were talking to friends, if you were talking to family, right? And they ask about this thing called Springpoint. How would you respond to that in a way that really told them the heart of the work, told them about the heart of why this thing exists? So if you were at that social event and someone said, I heard about this Springpoint thing, what is it? How would you describe it then?
That is a great question, and it's a question I've actually been thinking about myself. I have actually had to go back to the website because I don't have an elevator pitch for what is Springpoint. I generally call it an organization that works around issues of social justice that has iterated over time into that form but it's also animal justice and all kinds of other justice besides just human justice. I need to bone up on my elevator speak about what Spring Point Partners and Ember is. I see it as a growing and evolving organization, even as young as it is, mm-hmm. than exactly what it is.
And that's a perfect place to go. And exactly why I said the formal language is yeah. one thing, but I think it's the heart of it.
I mean, I do mm-hmm. I send people to the website. I really do, because it's multi-layered, it's multi-dimensional. It's not one thing. It's many different things, which is, I think, part of the problem with elevator speak, you know, your elevator speech.
I heard the question differently, and I'm glad, because I don't have elevator speak either, and I'm horrible at it. What I heard you ask, you know, network solutions leaders is more what we've, where we've gotten.
Mm-hmm.
But the heart of why it exists mm-hmm. goes way back to the origin story. And so to me, those were my notes as Jessica was talking. Just, I mean, I think we looked at Dad's legacy and looked at each other and said, why? For what? For what purpose? And really looked at it as an opportunity to do something, to learn something, to experiment, to make change. But the notion of, like, let's use this opportunity. And Jessica, I think, is more articulate about the true origin story of years ago. But I also really felt personally like I had three offspring that I feel very responsible for the whole Berwyn enterprise / organization, and always viewed doing something like Spring Point as what I always called another atom on the molecule of this thing, so that future generations could attach to a source of the wealth, not just by working at the business. That there was a lot more that different ways to connect and handles to grab onto. So that would be my answer about like what was in my heart at the beginning of all this.
So one thing that comes up for me is how much easier I think it would have been to simply say, here's the enterprise, and we can just assume expected positions and run with it, right? And instead, I'm curious about what happened that caused you, your siblings, to kind of think about a different expression of the work, like how you might be able to put your personal touch on it, how you might be able to maybe scaffold, right, build on what was there, but also shift gears a little bit or a lot and land in a completely different place. I imagine there were quite a few conversations. Catherine, of course, talks about this kitchen table conversation, but even before that, I wonder what was happening. Jessica, I know you tend to be so in tune with your body. We know that we always talk about the body. Your body mm-hmm. keeps the score. And as a person who leans on her intuition as well, can you take us back to what was going on in your body, in your heart, in your mind
oh, yeah.
that made you say, you know what? We need to do something different.
Well, I mean, I'll try and make this, summarize it. But for, as I think you know, for about 10 years, I had an art gallery in Philly. And when I decided to close it for really lack of revenues and lack of sustainability, I was in my mid-30s and had really never engaged with the enterprise of Berwyn Corporation. I didn't ever feel there was a place for me there, so I didn't try. But when I closed the gallery, I decided I really needed to dip my toe into the Burr World universe and see how it felt. You know, was it hot? Was it cold? Was it, you know, body temperature? And I worked at ColorCon for about a year, mostly in marketing. And then when I was pretty much kicked out of there by the CEO of ColorCon, because he said he needed the office, but I think he just didn't want
my little
anymore.
Story there.
Understood. But it was a really good experience. And, you know, I consulted with a whole bunch of people, some of whom were in Dad's orbit, Jim Hamling, Lawrence Carlson. And they kind of helped guide me along this journey of sort of looking in experimentation to see if there was a place for me within the family enterprise, which I just didn't feel there was.
I remember sitting on a bench
in the Rittenhouse Square.
Exactly.
So I came in and I didn't really have a lot of skills for, you know, corporate enterprise to contribute. I sort of found my place in marketing and communications. There was a lot of work to do in that arena at Berwind. At that point, we had zero collateral materials. There was no website. So I kind of latched on to that as my purpose. But I had also been over the, you know, 15 or almost 20 years of my career in the arts involved in a lot of nonprofit organizations on some boards and contributing in various different ways and other arts organizations, not just arts organizations, but a number of different ones. And I saw a lot of need in the world and in Philly. And so another sort of thing I took on for myself was the corporate philanthropy. And it all didn't feel right to me. So we tried to tweak it. We tried to adjust it a little bit. The whole concept of corporate social responsibility came into being. I didn't really like that phrase, as I think is known by many now. I had a lot of arguments with my father about the utilization of resources from the enterprise to actually have a more meaningful impact in the world and in our community. And kind of with or without his sort of permission, which we all still needed at that point in time, which was tough, you know, in your late 30s. I was reading a lot. I was reading Muhammad Yunus. I was reading about the Republic of Tea in Patagonia and all these other sort of triple bottom line businesses. I was really intrigued because they were authentic, really authentic efforts to make the world a better place, not just to reflect on their organizations well and give them sort of a halo effect. But these felt like real things, especially Muhammad Yunus and the work that he was doing, for which he later won a Nobel Prize. But so, I don't know, I was introduced to Catherine Murphy, who's been, you know, creating and running the organization for over 15 years, after I was speaking with a mutual friend of ours about sort of what my dream was. And she introduced me to Catherine because she knew Catherine was ready to make a change. And then about a year later, when we finally had some kind of a plan and a budget and a job description, we brought Catherine and others back in to interview as the director of this thing that was going to become something, but we didn't know what yet. So that's kind of a shortish version of what went on. There were a lot of fights, a lot of arguments, especially between me and my dad. There were a lot of mistakes. There were a lot of missteps. There were, I think when we started out sort of trying to improve the philanthropy that we did, it's a word I don't like and never did like. It's sort of like charity to me. It feels unempowering, both of those words do. I can't remember where I was going with that. But I had this great sense of confidence, especially once Catherine was on board. And my other three siblings were also on board, and a dad eventually was on board too before he died. He got it. He saw it. Didn't know what was going to happen, but it felt like the right thing.
I'm curious about what made you fight on, because it sounds like it certainly took some time to get to buy-in and the ability to move forward. So
the buy-in was hard, and there was no buy-in on the 30th floor, as we referred to, you know, Berwind back then, because it was on the 30th floor of the building around the corner. I just knew in my heart, that's kind of how I work. I just knew in my gut and my heart that, you know, if my name was going to be associated with this thing, it had to be more than just beating the averages and making money. That I didn't value money enough to work towards that goal, you know, and leaving
wealth for the next generation just wasn't something that felt to me like something I wanted to give my time to. So, and because I was doing all this reading, and it was a new frontier, really was, the kind of work Eunice was doing, the kind of work Paul Newman was doing, Republic of Tea, Patagonia, I think Starbucks used to be that way, way back in the day. I thought, okay, this is a possibility. It's worth it. It's worth giving it a shot. We also needed a family office because there was a lot going on that was, I think that was actually the entry point. And I got the buy-in for that initially, but I knew it was a bit sneaky that
Trojan
horse, it was a little Trojan horse thing, you know, that the entry was going to be, the Trojan horse was going to be the family office, because I did have buy-in for that. I mean, time and resources and not money, but time and resources and things like that, that I felt very, very, we, I think, all felt very strongly needed to be separated out of Corp and managed by another body, you know, that might be called the family office. And through that, you know, staffing that, all of this other work could begin to be talked about, could begin to be explored, could begin to be co-created.
Thank you for that.
That, mm-hmm. It's that.
And that's why elevator pitches
don't work, right?
You actually pounded on your chest. Yeah. You talked about possibility.
Yeah.
You talked about your heart. And that's, I think, the way those of us who now have an opportunity to work with you, to work with Spring Point, that's what it feels like, right? There are the words that we use, I think, in more formal places. But at the end of the day, your heart has to be in it.
We don't always have the opportunity to speak from the heart, and it's not always appropriate, I think. I think the other side of it, the elevator speak, you know, is important. Sometimes you only have 60 seconds. And if you're kind of like, then you've lost an opportunity right there, you know. So you need them both. I think you need them both and lots of stuff in between.
Joanna, as Jessica was talking, one of the things that you hopped in and just kind of touched, and I'm curious about it, was a conversation on the bench. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, I mean, for all the things I don't remember in my life, there are some, obviously we all have these, some really clear, crystal clear moments, and that conversation, I mean, I can remember the bench, not just a bench. I know exactly what bench. Well, are we even in? It's funny because Jessica says, she always had that sort of feeling, you know, you always had that feeling in your heart, you know, and we're doing kind of your own learning and own investigation of things outside of Berwind, of organizations like Patagonia, et cetera, that we're doing these things. I was so trapped in my head that I couldn't feel, I didn't know what was in my heart. I just knew that I had to get a job done. There was a job I had to do, and that was to be, you know, to work for Dad and make sure this thing got carried on. And the disconnect between my heart and my head was vast. Let's just put it that way. But when Jessica, I just remember, you know, she said, I'm having conversations with people, and I'm thinking about just exploring, dipping my toe in, as she said, and seeing, you know, what Berwind might kind of have to offer, or if I can see myself there, or et cetera. And she was looking for my guidance, and I think I said, God knows what I said, but what I believe I said was, why not, and just give it a try. And although I probably didn't have the language for this, and we are so different, I think what I was trying to say was trust the process a little bit and just give it a chance and see what happens. And the hard thing about being at Berwind,
as you were for quite a while before that.
Yes.
And I had not been.
Yes, since like 16, because I started working in the medical company with all the typers and the smoke. That's all I remember about that. And then the next summer it was somewhere else. And seriously, it was their nails and cigarette smoke everywhere. That's all I remember. No, but the difficult thing, and also maybe the brilliant thing. So we talk about paradoxes a lot at Berwyn, but Dad was like, oh, you're coming here. And I was such a follower. There was no debate. But you have to figure out what you're going to do here. There's no role for you. You're not taking any job from it. You're not going to be this role. You will not be taking somebody else's job. And I'm like, okay, well, what the f*** then? Like, what am I? I was an English major at Wesleyan. I'm like, okay. So, but that was also brilliant because then you kind of found your way. So I don't know. And that's, I think I probably shared that with Jessica as well. It's kind of like, come and figure some, find some. The notebooks that I have that talk about trying to start an HR department, strategic human resources. I mean, I have pages of trying to get that done. Didn't go anywhere. Now look at us, right? It's fascinating. But it really was like, you will be coming here. And I'm like, okay, tell me, you know, but find your role. And I, in a way, I can't tell whether that was the worst or brilliant or some combination of both. Because what it did is it allowed you to be there without, I wasn't going to be an accountant. I wasn't going to be an ex. I wasn't, you know, so, or legal or whatever. So, but it allowed you to find, or allowed me to find a way. Although I will also say it took a long time and it took a lot of pain and a lot of just subjugation of who I was as a person.
Mm-hmm. Subjugation of who you were as a person. And a little earlier, you talked about being trapped in your head, right? Being so trapped in your head that you couldn't even hear, I think, the sound of your heart. What was that grappling about? What was that like? And how did you break free of that?
Well, I mean, I'm going to share this, and I think you know some of the answer, and you can decide whether to cut it or not. I don't know, but I have only one answer. Starting around the age of 10, I remember I went to my mom and I said to her, I have no idea whether I am hungry or absolutely stuffed. If a child said that to any one of us today, we'd be like, yo, you need some help. Because the disconnect between mind and body, to have no idea what's here, or to have to push it so far underground that to just go on the mental, you know, etc. So I think that's the way my coping was, to turn to focusing on food. I mean, everybody says an eating disorder is about control. And of course it is to some degree, so many things are. But I really think it was, how can I spend time thinking about something else so that I don't have to spend so much time thinking about what a mess it all is over here, you know? And so that, you know, and it was a good, you know, and she was like, oh, that makes no sense. That's 76. You know, nobody was talking about that stuff. No. All I know is, you know, I can go back through math textbooks and they're just lists of calories. I had to spend time doing something else because I couldn't handle the other stuff. And so that disconnect became actually even greater. It didn't, you know, didn't help the situation. So that, I think it was the split. It was the split between the mind and the body, you know, and it was the mind I could do, like straight A's, great. You know, figure this out, sure. Navigate being one person at mom's house and another person at my dad's house, got that. You know, there was like there was a lot going on to the point where I really had no idea who I was. I had no idea who I was or what I believed or what I wanted or, you know, all of those things. So finally, I was working for an organization called A Chance to Heal, and they wanted me to be, I was on the board, and they wanted, and it's an organization that helps, we were working to help prevent the instance of eating disorders in young boys and women and older women, and, you know, knew all the statistics. And the woman who founded it
Ivy Silver, and it did a lot of great work. She asked me to become the chairman of the board, and the cognitive dissonance of being extremely thin. And really, something caught my attention. I was like, I cannot be the leader of this organization. And then people like Catherine and the man that I was dating at that time were like, it's an unsustainable lifestyle, thank God. And then there was a lot of convincing and support from Jessica and my mom to then tell my dad that I was going away. I remember that conversation. He gave me permission because I had given so much time to Berwyn. He thought it was okay if I took this time to go take care of myself.
Yeah.
And I spent a lot of time in treatment thinking about, why do people turn to coping mechanisms? And I think a lot of times it's that lack of agency. It's that disconnect between heart and head, not knowing, you know, not having that kind of alignment, and hence the birth of the hive when I came back. I don't know if that was the answer you were looking for, but that's the answer I have.
It's an even better answer. And I've heard the stories before, but not in depth in this way. So I just thank you.
Sure.
Just for your candor. And one of the things that's coming up for me is the moment of inflection. Right? There was a bit of an inflection point for both of you over time, right? But Spring Point wasn't just about a departure from this entity, this company, or doing your own thing, having your thumbprint on something new. This was life for you, right? In so many ways. And so it makes sense that you describe this from the heart, that you describe this as such a bigger thing. It's so much bigger than I think any website. Mm. And our website is kind of cool. Yeah,
right? Very.
But it's so much bigger than I think words can capture for what it meant for you in those moments and the fights that you had to kind of push through to get here.
I have to say, though, I have to add, because I think it's so important. This was a time Dad was dying had just passed or was dying. And I was really following Jessica's following of her heart, because I didn't really know. I mean, I knew I cared deeply about people, about all the people that, like, I had the same thing in me. I just hadn't articulated it, hadn't been more curious about it, et cetera. And I was very much following Jessica's, I'd say, passion and leadership, thinking leadership. And I was like sitting around the table, you know, in that year, we spent a year after Dad passed. Like, are we going to do this, guys, with my siblings and our advisors? Like, let's not just do this. Let's re-choose it or not choose it. And it was very much Jessica and I just looking at each other like, yeah, but we don't wake up in the morning to go, well, I'm going to beat the averages. That's why we're going to do this. You know, and so, and several days before Dad passed, he said sort of very quietly, because we couldn't hear him very well, make this what you want it to be for you. I made it what I needed it to be for me. And to me, that was a big inflection point. And then, again, sort of watching Jessica take the lead on the thinking, I was very much like, yes, let's go. I remember that meeting, too, in the Ritz, the big table. And you were sitting at the head at the right. Anyway.
What comes up for you?
Well, I didn't know that you were sort of taking my lead on this. I wasn't really thinking about that either, you know?
Right.
It just felt like something that had to be done. It didn't feel optional. Yeah. I think for me, and it was so clear in my head that there was an opportunity. And that, I think, you know, I've said before, Joanna alluded to it earlier, you know, we don't have any obligation to do more. We pay our taxes. We pay our employees well. We have very little turnover. Nobody leaves here. We have no obligation to invest any more than we do, you know, in our communities. And I said, you know, well, we might not have an obligation, but we certainly have an opportunity. And, you know, the opportunity is what the four of us grabbed onto. There was an opportunity to do something
something important, you know, not just like have days off from work where you all put on the same t-shirt and go out and, you know, pick up trash or whatever, you know? I mean, that's not meaningful, you know? It's fun. It can be fun, but you're not even sure you're contributing in the right way to the people you're supposed to be helping, you know? It's your choice, not their choice, you know? Right. And I think as you were talking about this, I was reflecting on kind of the power that Dad had he had it universally. I remember Joanna walking into my office. We had, her office was here, my office was here, and then there was a secretary in the middle. And she came in, you came into my office and you sat down across the desk from me and you said, I don't know what the f*** I'm doing here. And it was painful, you know, because it's your time, it's your life, it's your... Anyway, that's all in the past, but I think what I was going to say is...
It's mostly in the past. It'll never be 100% in the past.
But what I was going to say is I think it was incredibly gratifying before our dad died to actually have... Even that little bit of support, sort of go forward with this, you know, see what you can make of it. It was, there was some, I think for me, it might have meant, you know, aside from what it meant personally, I'd given up on that possibility or even the hope of that possibility. I didn't care anymore. I really didn't. I understood who he was, where he came from, what happened to him. And I had long ago given up the hope that, you know,
there's going to be this
there
flowering.
There was going to be this, you know, this flowering or of support. I knew what I was going to do. I just decided to do it, no matter how much time it took. I just had given up on all of that. But in retrospect, and even then, it really was a gift. Really, it was a gift to, before he died, know that on some level, he... wanted to see this go forward, whatever this was, you know, and that there was a lot of passion around it and that even some of his advisors were supporting, you know, even in it, what we were talking about in very vague ways, you know. I didn't feel I needed it, but I wanted it.
Yeah.
And in retrospect, I think he would be really proud of what is being done at Spring Point Partners, you know, and the influence that it's had beyond our organization. It seems to be becoming a model for other like-minded organizations who don't quite know how to do it, you know, and didn't have the guts to do it without knowing and make mistakes and kind of iterate and learn as we, you all, went along, you know, the sort of halo effect, which is, I think, just an early consequence of Spring Point Partners on the rest of the enterprise. Berwind has come sooner than I ever thought that it would. I knew that it would eventually, but I thought it was going to take, you know, 20 years. Well, it is kind of almost 20 years. You know, all those things are things that I do think about when I think about what would Dad think, which I don't think about it that often. I think he would be really proud.
I love watching you get to that point. You mentioned welcoming uncertainty. You mentioned mistake making. You mentioned iterating along the way, right? As some of the things that you just had to do in order to grow this thing called Spring Point. But it sounds like the work became an outgrowth of your own personal learning and you know, becoming more sure-footed in the world. There are founders or future founders who might be at that place where you were many years ago, grappling with, you know, that cognitive dissonance between heart and mind and expectations and all the things you went through. To them, what would you say to keep in mind? What would your advice be now that you have the benefit of hindsight and of engaging in that mistake making and iterating and welcoming uncertainty. What would you say to someone who's sitting there having that moment, probably in that office, typing away and feeling like this isn't it? Maybe there's no smoke anymore, but you know, all the other conditions might be there. What would you say to them?
You know, there's probably lots of different answers to this. I'll give you a minute to think about it, but as I'm reflecting, no, your question is a really important one, I think. First of all, I think I feel like I want to say, and I feel like I need to say, we had a lot of privilege. We didn't have access to a lot in terms of resources and finances and stuff.
But let's pause there for a second, because I think the average person would be curious about what that means, right? So you had a lot, but you didn't necessarily have access to it. What does that mean?
Yeah. I mean, I literally just had this conversation with my son, because raising children with wealth is not an easy thing. And I told him that I wanted to spend some time with him sharing the stories of my own upbringing, my sort of, and I was joking with him that like it's this end of the year feedback time, right? Like everybody gets like reviews and does. So I've spent, you know, I had Jim today, Adam, you know, Thelma, da 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 da, and I'm in the shower and I'm like, nobody gives me feedback. and I said to him, you know, and this does relate, and I said, you know, I don't know. I could be doing a ass job, but here I am the owner. And so here we go, like, keep going, which I don't really believe. But I thought it was an important message to him. And he said, Mom, you're the only person that I can think of that would ever think you were doing a ass job. And two, would have that mindset. And then I said, as the conversation went on, and we're still trying to navigate, you know, what the next generation in terms of access to resources, because we literally did not have access to resources. I mean, I couldn't buy a dishwasher, but I'm flying on a private plane. And I used that example with my son because I wanted to show him that the cognitive dissonance, no matter how, is going to be there. And it's how you navigate that cognitive dissonance and the decisions you make in that moment where you're addressing one thing or the other. So But I mean, the point is, it's just uncharted territory for me, you know, for everybody. But no, we did not. I mean, Jessica can probably speak to it more because that's a whole other story. I was like part of a different family. So, but there was lots of resources. I mean, not always. Again, you were growing up more at the time when Dad was really building.
Yes,
it was kind of well built by the time I got, you know, so it's a different story.
They are different stories.
And yet in both cases, although the wealth at some point was kind of in the background, there were limitations around your access.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, sorry, I interrupted you a little bit earlier, but just wanted to.
It's confusing, and I think you could probably see we're still both a little confused about it.
Exactly.
And by it.
Exactly.
And, you know, might not have the best tools to sort of integrate all of that with our own children and the other people in our orbits.
Exactly. But you were talking about privilege.
Yeah. So, and, you know, it's true. We did grow up with a lot of privilege. Access is different than privilege, I think. Yeah. I mean, it is confusing. But what was the question?
For those who might be in your shoes. Yeah.
So I've been thinking about this a lot in the last couple of days, maybe triggered by one of your prompts about things that are resonating with me right now. And I'm not sure if you asked the question in your email, you know, what advice would you give to somebody trying to do something similar, completely different, but build something? I have such admiration for people who do stuff against the odds, because that is the f-ing world we're living in right now, you know, in many ways. You know, so my privilege comes into play here because I had access to a lot of resources when I did, you know, and now that we do, we have access to a lot of resources. most people don't have that kind of access. So, and I think that's where I was going with the privilege thing. Many people, probably the majority of people who want to build something or have a dream, have to go outside, way outside of their orbit and way outside of their comfort zone to find access to the resources that they need to build something. It's worth it. You know, I would think I didn't have to go outside, you know, of my orbit. I've had to fight for it, you know, more than I do now. And it was uncomfortable. So it was even uncomfortable for us, I think, at a time when we were fighting for access to resources. It was our own family network, you know, but it wasn't just handed over. You know, you had to write a paper and, you know, give a speech and, you know, those didn't ever result in anything other than shame. That was even before this. But, you know, all I can say is surround yourself with people who believe in you or who believe in the vision, even if it's not 100% clear. And again, that's the privilege comes in there too, because it's not always the case where you can build something without a clear vision. You know, we started building something with a little bit of a Trojan horse. Sometimes that works. I would always recommend a Trojan horse. I definitely recommend Trojan horses. They work because it's a workaround, you know, until your vision gets clearer. To be around other people, Joanna, James and Graham, Catherine, you know, some of the other people who really helped RG, Jim Hamling, but, you know, surround yourself with people that you trust who can help you clarify your vision, for one. You know, take it out of the heart and put it into the universe as an operating entity, you know, that has some form, you know, and substance where people can come in and work on concrete things, you know, and iterate, because you have to iterate. You have to be willing to make mistakes. You have to know what your strengths and weaknesses are. That's boring, right? Who wants to do that every day? Keep going from A to B, you know? But I have a box in my studio, and it's a beautiful wooden box that I taped blue tape, which every metalsmith and every artist needs in their possession at all times, and it says mistakes. And inside that box are some things that nobody else would recognize as opportunities, but these things that I melted because I applied too much heat, or I did this step before that step and I needed to do these other three steps, melted into just a ball of nothing. But those are the things that always led to the next piece. You know, they always led to the next opportunity, the next idea that might have gone off in a different direction. But I treasure this little box of mistakes because those are the mistakes that kept me from just doing A to B, 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 you know, over and over again and expecting a different result, you know? So I think you have to be vulnerable. You have to be willing to accept that not only you are going to make mistakes, but people around you are going to make mistakes, and that they need to be forgiven if they are that, and that they are learning opportunities. Keep your mistakes. Yeah. Hold on to your mistakes. Hold on to your accidents, you know? I should have a box called accidents too, you know? Maybe that's what it is called. I think, I'm not sure. Maybe I do have two boxes. But mistakes, accidents, missteps are all part. They're all going to be part of it.
When we talk to Simran, who's our EVP of Impact, she tells quite frequently the story of her beginning on the other side of the table when she was a grantee and mm-hmm. was working with you early on and received some funding. Mm-hmm. And it did not go well. Whatever the thing was she was supposed to deliver, it just did not manifest in the way that she envisioned. And she came back to you, and she paints such a vivid picture of just being really nervous, and at that point was convinced that the relationship was over. and she would be moving on. So she was very resolute in her position, right, that this was over. Because that is what happens with more traditional funders, yeah. right? You say you're going to do a thing, you don't do a thing, and the relationship sometimes suffers. But instead, you asked her what she learned, what she learned. And that for her was a pivotal moment, I think, in the work she does, and probably the beginning of her, I think, transitioning into working more directly with you and into her role. But I've always been curious about that question, right? And how, based on your background, you had the audacity isn't the right word, but maybe the, I don't even know what the right word is, but what made you become such avid stewards of learning as a leadership competency, as a thing that as human beings we ought to carry forward? We see learning sprinkled throughout everything we do at Spring Point. And whenever we engage in that mistake making and have a lot that we can put in that box, Jessica, I think Catherine reminds us, Simran reminds us, you remind us, and you've done it for me personally, right? What did you learn? It's such a big question. And I'm wondering if you could talk to how that was seeded in you, because you're seeding it in the rest of us and in this thing we call Spring Point.
I call it neglect more than anything else.
Ignorance?
In my... So we're 10 years apart, just so you know everybody's clear on that. We did grow up in slightly different families.
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting.
Yeah, we really did.
That'll be our next episode, by the way.
Yeah, exactly.
We definitely
In my case... and this is not all good, but, there are some benefits to it. I think I would have to call it neglect. So it was survival. In my case, I think, I was one of those kids who, my generation, you got on a bike and you didn't come back until the streetlights came on and nobody knew where you were. And they really didn't care. And it was okay, right? And it was fun. And you got into trouble, but nobody was like checking, their messages to see you left and you came back 5 hours later. I did many things I shouldn't have done in those 5 hour time periods. But, I think you also learn. I mean, I if I needed to go somewhere, I walked from my house 30 minutes to the train station and I got on a train and I went wherever I was going to go. And then I went wherever I got to, and then I got back on the train, and I got back, and I walked back home. I mean, I walked everywhere. I rode a bike, So I think that neglect, and I don't know if everybody would call it neglect, but I think there are other factors that might contribute to the concept of neglect in that scenario. I think you just learn to be self-sufficient. You also learn to have trouble trusting other people at times. And so in my case, and I don't think I can speak for anybody else and not my sister sitting next to me, but I think I just learned some survival skills early on, and I also didn't frankly feel like I fit in anywhere. So, my strategy coming into a really uncomfortable situation was finding the holes, or at least what I perceived to be the holes, and then filling them, figuring out a way to fill them. Otherwise, where was I going to go? Where did I belong? So if I could find the holes and then plug the holes, but I had to find the holes first.
Right.
So that's, I think that's my own makeup. That's kind of that was my own need and my own makeup and a way for me to kind of feel whole without a lot of external support.
You said it's survival, right?
It is. Survival. It's kind of survival.
Mm-hmm. I thank you for that time to think about how I would answer this question. And I think the question is, how did the question of what did you learn get so deep-seated in your kind of psyche and your regular vocabulary and way of being in the world? And I go back to parenting and the books that I read, which I'm now starting to pull out because they've really had such a huge influence on how I parent and the hive. So I think it would be interesting to go back, and I have them all, There's a book called Not Under My Roof, which is spectacular, and it's about the Danish way of looking at relationships between young boys and girls in your home and stuff like that. I have another by Ron Taffel. I mean, these are books that I used parenting by heart. And I really, and I, when I was parenting with somebody that didn't have the same approach to parenting, I kind of got firmer in my approach to parenting, which was really, you may have made that mistake. You may have done, but what did you learn from it? And that was really an orientation that I had, was like, okay, but there's more to this is wrong and this is right.
But that's not how we were parented.
Definitely at not
all.
How.
Not at, so.
Oh, not at all.
It wasn't as if it came out of our
families. No, which
families
is why I
origin.
Think I have a stack of books this big.
And I had to reinvent that.
No, for sure. And then I think with Jessica's particular interest in and leadership at Ember on the whole learning front, that has kind of re-emphasized for the culture of Spring Point Partners, what did we learn and what can be learned from that experience, and that we don't all learn the same way. And so I think it's multiple things.
Speaking of learning, and as we are wrapping up, I am curious about what you are into in this moment. What are you reading? What are you listening to? Yeah, what song have you heard? What quote are you holding on to that you might want to share with others, that you believe that the thing that anchors you in this moment?
I have, because you gave us those prompts that we weren't supposed to think about, I did a lot of thinking.
Of course.
And there are a few, and I'll start with the quote that has sort of anchored me in the lately, and that is the Viktor Frankl quote of, between stimulus and response there is a space, and in that space is your choice. It's, or the greater the degree of space, the more freedom you have, because you're responding, you're not reacting, you're not hooked. So I love that quote. And he was a Holocaust survivor, and he invented a theory called, I can't remember, but it was by watching how people behaved. And it was fascinating, but it's such a good quote. And then I'll just say the other two people that have grounded me lately are Mary Oliver, the poet, and an interview of her by Krista Tippett, and just how language and nature have grounded her and basically saved her life. And then most recently, but also this is a woman that I go back to, and I don't know how to pronounce her name, Jhumpalahiri or Humpalahiri. But this book, In Other Words, is a book on writing. And she grew up between America and India, and so she was speaking Bengali and English. But they spent a lot of, she fell in love with Rome. And this is her first book written in Italian.
Have you read?
Because it's Italian on the left, it's English on the right. But what it is, and I think you would find it interesting.
Oh, you're writing it down.
Is she wanted to write in a different language to understand better who she was between these split cultures. And it's,
I love her.
It's absolutely, and I've read it twice, and I've marked it up, and I've done all these things, and I just think she's spectacular. And the notion of discovering yourself and being brave enough to keep a box of mistakes, to use your metaphor, you know, in writing, it's editing and crossing out and doing all that. Never throw that stuff away. Just put it in a drawer. So those are the three that have been really grounding me and resonating with me right now.
Wow. Yeah. So I'm not reading anything that's really stimulating me right now. The book I have, I guess, 10, 15 books going, but none of them are holding my attention. But I don't think that's the books. I think that's my psyche right now. And one of them is Braiding Sweetgrass, which is just a treasure of a book. And I came I feel like I'm getting closer and closer and closer to actually meeting this woman. But based on your prompt, which I didn't give a lot of thought to because I didn't want to overthink it,
like some people.
And me too, sometimes. No, but so just by coincidence, I have been trying to, not by coincidence, this is intentional. I'm someone who always keeps background something on, and I have stopped doing that. I have decided there's a lot of noise, and it's not good for me to have that noise in my ears all the time and in my head all the time. It's just too much content, too much to think about, and it's overwhelming, and it's I'm not being quiet. So quiet is what I'm gravitating to, if possible, in the woods or in nature somewhere. It's harder for me inside than it is outside. My safe place right now is outdoors under any circumstances. I walk a lot. I don't use earphones. I don't use headphones. I don't listen to podcasts. I'm not listening to the news. So yesterday, I was scrolling through Instagram and I came across, I just started following Yo-Yo Ma. Have you ever heard of him? He's amazing.
A little bit here and there.
Right. So, I mean, of course, everybody knows who Yo-Yo Ma is. And I really haven't paid that much attention to him. But I came upon this post of Yo-Yo Ma's. And if I could only navigate my... There we go.
Nope.
He's doing a 5-year project around the world. I know I can do this. Here it is. And I read the caption, and it really moved me deeply. The image is Red Hook, or Red Rocks Theater, which I've actually seen because it's in Denver. It's just outside of Denver. Beautiful, beautiful venue for music. And so Yo-Yo Ma writes, on August 1st, 2018, I walked on stage at Red Rocks in Colorado and played the opening notes of Bach's Cello Suites, music that's been with me my entire life. It was now the start of a new journey, 36 communities on 6 continents over 5 years. The Bach Project was my response to anxiety and division in the world unlike any I had felt before. Bach's music, with its extraordinary empathy and soaring into imagination, is one way that I can invite people to sit together, listen, and share an experience. So in each place, I played these suites as an offering and asked a simple question: how else is culture helping us imagine and build a better world? And I went like straight to Spotify and I listened to that. And then last night, and it's like 2.5 hours. And last night I listened to it again as I was falling asleep, and I was sobbing listening to this music. I mean, the man is he's a genius. I don't know anything about playing the cello. I listen to all kinds of music. I don't listen to classical music that often. I was so moved by this body of work and the way that he was, I feel like I learned so much, I couldn't articulate to you what I learned, but I was literally listening to this as I was falling asleep and sobbing. That resonated with me somehow, I don't know how. It's not a thing you can necessarily put words to, but it's the Cello Suite No. 2 in D minor, Bach, and listen to it. I mean, it's extraordinary. A book that I'm also reading, you were actually asking about creativity too, which there's a book someone gave me over the summer by Rick Rubin called The Creative Act.
So
amazing.
Good.
Amazing.
I mean, so good. Rick Rubin too.
You know, creativity, there lots and lots of people use, they reserve the word creativity for artists. It is not reserved for artists. You're creating every minute. We're all creating right now. Creativity is not a word that should be reserved for people who produce artwork of any kind, whether it's music, metalwork, painting, drawing, writing. You know, creativity is what we employ all day, every day, to grow and to make the world a better place.
I'm smiling so broadly over here because before I came up with my answers to your question, I was reflecting and I was like, too much. There's too much input.
Just too much.
Too many inputs. Yeah. So that's why I go into the woods with nothing for an hour and a half, 2 hours, and just, no, I don't want inputs. Mm-hmm. But a very cool input is the interview that the 10% Happier, who I loved, Dan Lewis,
I know the name.
So he interviews Rick Rubin about the process of that book and how that came about. And it's just brilliant.
I read about how it came about.
And I sent it to the boys on the West Coast. so good.
I think it's a word that should be part of everybody's. And I think I'm not 100% sure why he wrote the book. I think I know how he wrote the book, but I think he was trying to, well, you probably know better than I do.
I think it took him he just wrote bits down on pieces of paper and collected them. And anyway, it's such a great book and it's a great interview.
Have you read it?
I am reading it. I think I have it on audio books because I kept listening to podcasts where he spoke.
Yeah.
And I think he did a really good job of reminding us that creativity is just part of the human condition.
Exactly.
And to Jessica's point, we keep thinking about this.
Exactly. Over
this thing
here.
Is a skill, right? that some people have.
He says this, creativity has a place in everyone's life and everyone can make that place larger. In fact, there are a few more important responsibilities.
You know, and just to circle back, which you're all probably like, oh my God, would they both shut up? But I remember coming back from Babson. Learning, you know, thinking, spending the day thinking about entrepreneurship and stuff, and coming back and Spring Point Partners was an act of creativity on our part in some ways.
Oh, for sure.
And I came back and I said to Jessica, we're actually entrepreneurs.
Yeah, you did. I remember that. Yeah.
I would never describe myself. But just to link it all, it's like creativity, space, trust.
Yeah. And if you know exactly where you're going, there's some creativity in that, but, you know, I think everyone needs to embrace that concept of creativity as part of anything worth doing.
Mm-hmm. You know, you touched on this, and I'll close out after this, but through our conversation, these words have been coming up. I've been writing down kind of the salient themes. And it's interesting to me that they speak to Spring Point's values, right? In many ways, you talked about putting people first. Mm-hmm. You talked a lot about humility and vulnerability. You talked about collaboration. Trust has been, I think, at the center of this conversation. Yeah. And all of that, I think, is also undergirded by learning. And we talked about access, right? And there's equity in, I think, the way you were thinking and talking about it. And I was going to do a rapid round with the values, but I think you have already kind of spelled out how all of those values live in the work that you do and in Spring Point. So I'm thankful that that came up organically, and I'm not at all surprised. I'll end with this, which is really a question that I think you've answered, but I'd love to hear you more explicitly respond to it. In this moment, what gives you joy?
Gratitude for all, really, that we have been given, but more importantly, created together. Gratitude for my children and what they teach me every day. And that just, I'm very, very lucky. I feel very, very lucky in the best sense of the word. So that's what brings me joy.
Nature. Honestly, my faith is in nature. I think this planet is going to squirt us out of the universe like a watermelon seed, never to be seen again, as I would too if I was this planet. I just think humans right now are just not the best. We're not at our best time, you know, in the Anthropocene, I think. Growth gives me joy. I think when I'm not growing and the people around me aren't growing and I don't have things growing in my home, I've been propagating. I don't know what's happening with me, but watching things grow, including myself, and I don't necessarily see that I'm growing, but growth gives me joy, really. Yeah, and that includes all the things that Joanna said, and my own daughter, who's in a huge growth period right now. And I think I am too. I'm in a little bit of a stagnation, and I'm not sure where the growth is happening and where the stagnation's happening, but some of it happens simultaneously, you know, but stagnation doesn't give me joy.
But growth does.
Growth gives me joy.
Wonderful. Yeah. You have grown an incredible organization out of your creativity, out of your restlessness, out of that grappling and that cognitive dissonance between heart and mind. And I'm so happy you fought for it. Mm. And equally grateful.
Me too.
Right? So I lied. I said how we started. I had my last question, but here's my last question. And that is, you came in a little bit anxious. One word, how are you feeling now?
Anxious. It has nothing to do with this. It has to do with the state of the world that we're in. I feel very just concerned about just the state of the world that we're in. You know, it terrifies me that you-know-who, I'm not going to record that name, is leaning in the polls. Just that's where my anxiety is. I just don't have a sense of what's going to happen next, you know, and there's only so much you can control, you know, not much, really. You can influence, you know, and you can get your little Trojan horses in there. Write that down. Put that down for those people. Take your Trojan horse with you. But there's, you know, how much can you really control? Let's just think the state of the world is difficult right now.
I don't feel as anxious because, being a type A perfectionist, I did my homework and I think I did okay. How stupid is that?
Authentic is very stupid.
Different in that regard. Very, very different.
But really just grateful to be reminded with my sister, who I love dearly, that there's still so much to learn about each other and our journey together.
Yeah.
And that is pretty incredible, you know, and so lucky that we get to do that. So that's how I'm feeling.
Yeah, I do too. No, thank you for saying that. And I do too. Yeah.
I am deeply grateful to you both. I wish we had video so people could see you holding hands in that moment. That gives me incredible joy. I'm grateful for our time together, Jessica and Joanna. Thank you both so much.
Thank you. We are very grateful.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Our Wellspring. This episode was produced by SpringPoint Partners in collaboration with Witty Gritty and edited by Andrew Gormley. If you have thoughts on the conversation you just heard, want to share your own story, or if you have ideas on what we should talk about in future episodes, please check the show notes. You can find us at thespringpoint.com. Until next time, hasta la próxima.